Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Something mysterious plagues County Mayo on the west coast of Ireland and its legendary Gaelic football team.
Sometimes I think there's something sinister going on.
I believe in the curse. I think it's real.
Listen to the curious tale of the Mayo Curse on Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 25th of December, these are our main stories. At his Christmas Eve Mass, Pope Francis appealed for peace as dozens are reported killed at a refugee camp in Gaza in the latest Israeli airstrike. In Serbia, demonstrations which turned violent are broken up by the police. They followed last week's elections, which the opposition says were marred by fraud. The British billionaire Jim Ratcliffe is buying a 25% stake in Manchester United Football Club at a cost of $1.6 billion. Also in this podcast...
Glad tidings of the Saviour bring, peace reign at Bashi Bay, ring on...
90 years after it was written, the Christmas carol performed in its hometown of Barnsley in the north of England. As the war in Gaza continues, celebrations for the Christian festival of Christmas have been cancelled in Bethlehem in the West Bank. It's the city, according to the Bible, where Jesus Christ was born more than 2,000 years ago, and it's a place usually filled with music and carols in December. But this year, there's no tree lighting up Manger Square, and the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church has built its manger from rubble. Its pastor, Mutter Isaac, told us why.
Jesus was born in times of hardship. He was born among an occupied family that had to leave Nazareth to Bethlehem because of a decree from the empire. Jesus survived a children massacre in Bethlehem when he was born. There was lament and sorrow in Bethlehem, and his family became refugees in Egypt. So the manger we created is not far from the true story of Christmas. Our children are under the rubble, our homes are destroyed. And we see a strong connection.
At the Vatican on Sunday night, Pope Francis appealed for peace in the Middle East as he presided over a solemn Christmas Eve Mass at St. Peter's Basilica. He spoke about the war between Israel and Hamas.
Tonight, our hearts are in Bethlehem, where the Prince of Peace is once more rejected by the futile logic of war, by the clash of arms that even today prevents him from finding room in the world.
Meanwhile, Israel is showing no signs of halting its operations in Gaza, as one of its spokesmen, Ilan Levy, told the BBC.
Our policy now is to continue putting unrelenting military pressure on Hamas, because standing by the sidelines was never an option. We are creating the conditions for Hamas to be willing to release the hostages it has brutally abducted and is holding without any access to the Red Cross, in flagrant violation of humanitarian law and every norm of human decency for those vulnerable hostages trapped in those terror dungeons.
Our correspondent Shaima Khalil travelled to Bethlehem.
On days like this, Jawdet and his father, Hanna, would have been talking about Christmas preparations. But not this year. Jawdet's family is trapped in northern Gaza. Communication has been impossible at times. So he's holding on to this patchy video call to get a glimpse of his father and to reassure him that they'll be together again. But his dad is overcome with grief and visibly emotional.
Hi, Khalti.
Your aunt.
A week ago, Jawdet's grandmother, Nahida, was shot twice in the stomach. His aunt, Samar, rushed to help her and was shot in the head. He shows me pictures of the immediate aftermath and then the funeral. His parents and relatives had been sheltering in the Holy Family Church. Now they've buried their loved ones there. The family blames Israeli snipers for their death. The IDF says it will continue its investigation. Jawdet's dad is in tears as he remembers that day.
It was a shock. It happened before our eyes. It was unbearable. I'm sorry, I can hardly speak. But it's just so difficult, we've endured so much. There's no safety, there's still shelling around us. I don't know if you can hear it.
Yes, we can hear it. Samin.
Before he says goodbye, he has a message for Jawdat.
May God be with you, my son. Take care of your sisters.
The war in Gaza weighs heavily on Bethlehem. Visitors from around the world would have been here by now. But Christmas celebrations have been cancelled this year.
It's empty. The city is empty from happiness, from joy, from kids, from Santa, from every celebration. There's no celebration this year.
We cannot celebrate the Christmas because, you know, we are not in another side of the world. We are, like, you know, still in Palestine.
It's so difficult. We're really struggling. Look at Bethlehem. It's never been this way.
In an unusually empty nativity church, Father Isath Al-Jiyah tells me his city feels like a shadow of itself.
12 years here as a priest of this church, and I was born in Bethlehem. I never actually seen like this. We have also brothers and sisters in Gaza, and this is what exactly makes it difficult also to celebrate and to have maybe to be united with prayers.
In Manger Square, a nativity scene in the rubble has replaced the giant Christmas tree, a tribute to the children in Gaza, and a call to end their suffering.
Shaima Khalil in Bethlehem. Next to Serbia and to the capital, Belgrade. Demonstrations took place on Sunday outside Serbia's Election Commission building and at the City Hall. Police used tear gas as some protesters tried to storm the City Hall. Windows were broken at the entrance of the building. The protesters shouted, "Open the door," and "Thieves." They'd gathered to call for a rerun of last week's parliamentary and local elections. Both domestic and international observers have condemned what they called serious irregularities, including the stuffing of ballot boxes and votes being bought. I spoke to our Balkans correspondent, Guy Deloney, and asked him how the demonstration was eventually broken up.
Now the opposition is saying that police used excessive force to break up their protest when it was in front of Belgrade City Hall. One member of parliament, the Green Left Front co-leader Radomir Lazovic, said officers beat him and another of other people with truncheons. And he said the police also used tear gas and pepper spray. It's quite interesting that you mention these attempts to get into the City Hall and the windows being smashed, Valerie, because, again, the opposition activists, particularly the students who've been involved in these protests every evening since last week's elections, say they weren't involved in those attempts, and they believe there were some agents provocateurs who were involved, who were there to make their protests look violent and for the opposition to look bad. So it's a tangled tale which is yet to be fully unwound.
And have the police made arrests?
The reports of a small number of arrests, but we're not talking about anything more than single figures at the moment. In terms of the numbers of people who were there, the authorities are talking about somewhere around 1,100 people. There's an analyst who regularly assesses the numbers of protests in Belgrade, who's reasonably independent. He puts the number around 7,000 people. So it's a significant number of people, but it's not exactly a mass movement. Nonetheless, it's been very persistent what's been happening in Belgrade over the past week. People particularly angry about what happened in the Belgrade city election, which was very much a target for the opposition, that they wanted to build on winning Belgrade City Council. That was their aim, that they could then build a platform to challenge the governing Progressive Party. The vote ended up being very close, and they're saying that these bust-in voters that they claim came into the city and voted for the Progressive Party could have made all the difference. And that's why they're asking for a rerun of the election in Belgrade.
There's going to be a partial rerun, though, isn't there?
Very, very partial. We're talking about three polling stations in the city, which the Belgrade Election Committee have decided to rerun next Saturday. That's not going to affect the overall result, because at the moment you've got the Progressive Party 39%, the main opposition coalition, 35%. So that's not going to make a big difference. So unless the government makes some sort of concessions, you can expect these protests to continue and intensify.
Guy Delaunay. The Chinese capital, Beijing, has experienced its coldest December since records began in 1951. The city endured 9 consecutive days with temperatures lower than minus 10 degrees Celsius. Mickey Brister reports.
It's been a year of extremes in the Chinese capital. 6 months ago, Beijing recorded its hottest ever June day, just over 40 degrees Celsius. It's currently enduring its coldest December on record, with temperatures frequently falling below minus 10. China has been hit with several waves of extremely cold weather already this winter. Parts of northern Japan have seen huge snowfall, and South Korea has been battling freezing temperatures. It's not clear how people are coping in North Korea.
Michael Bristow. Manchester United is one of the biggest names in world football and one of the wealthiest clubs. It was the home of David Beckham and Cristiano Ronaldo. Among its current highly paid players is Marcus Rashford. But its glory days seem to be disappearing. It's been a decade since Manchester United, owned by the American Glazer family, were last champions of England. So many fans will be delighted by news that the British businessman billionaire Jim Ratcliffe is buying a 25% stake in the club for around $1.6 billion. I heard more about the deal from our sports correspondent, Nesta McGregor.
Christmas has come early for some Manchester United fans, unless you're in a part of the world where it's already gone midnight. After 13 long months of negotiations, Sir Jim Ratcliffe, a lifelong Manchester United fan, is now a part owner of the team. But, and there is a big but, whilst Manchester United and Sir Jim Ratcliffe have agreed on a deal, the Premier League still has to sign this off. He still has to go through what they call a fit and proper owners and directors test. They want to know things like, has he got the money that he's promised? And more importantly, where did it come from? Now, Sir Jim Ratcliffe is one of the richest people in the UK and made his money from selling raw materials, from packaging for toiletries, medicines, food, to even mobile phones and furniture, most of the things that we use today. He'll be in charge of footballing operations for the men's, women's and academy teams at Manchester United. As well as that $1.6 billion investment you mentioned, immediately there will be a $300 million injection, which will go into refurbishing the famous but ageing Old Trafford Stadium.
And if it all goes ahead, I mean, how much power would it give him? Will he choose players? Will he choose managers? That's what people want to know.
Yeah, and the truth is, cliche or not, we'll just have to wait and see. Because, Valerie, this deal isn't like anything we've seen before. Think about it, a minority owner being in charge of running the football side of the club. So like you say, that does mean, potentially, the buying and selling of players and the hiring and firing of managers. But with the American family, the Glazers, who bought the club in 2005, still in total overall control. If the pair disagree on any deals, surely behind the scenes that can get messy. Lawyers might get involved. And you think on any major decision, Sir Jim might be outvoted as well. But I think any United fan unhappy with the way the Glazers have been running the club will be happy that they have a fan on the board. And that is the first step towards changing at the top.
Because Nesta, putting it in context, Man U has not been doing well, has it?
Maybe an understatement. Manchester United, was once all-conquering. But Valerie, this is the worst start to a league in 90 years. They're 8th in the Premier League. Remember, they're already out of European competition. And on and off the field, there has been turmoil with player indiscipline, the revolving door of managers. So yeah, real turmoil. But many people will see this deal, if it goes ahead, as a real change in the right direction.
Nesta McGregor. And before we move on, in an earlier podcast, we mentioned a story about a new NASA spacecraft, the Europa Clipper. We just want to point out that the poem to be engraved on the side of the craft was a NASA commission for the Europa mission. The BBC obtained permission to use it. The reading on the BBC was commissioned by Nicola Fox, who works for NASA.
Some people play golf on the weekends. I hunt con artists.
Unmissable podcasts from the BBC World Service.
Are County Mayo a great team blighted by mystical forces we can't comprehend?
I believe in the curse. I think it's real.
Telling stories from around the globe.
Every minute there's bombing and shelling. There is no safety.
If I get any internet connection, I'll talk to you again.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary, Amazing Sports Stories, and The Documentary, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You better be ready, because I'm going to bring it to you.
It's now 5 days since the election in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the official results of the country's presidential election are still to be announced. But one of the main opposition candidates is already crying foul, calling for the vote to be annulled. Moise Katumbi has demanded a fresh election, saying he has evidence of government officials stuffing ballot boxes. He urged people in the DRC to challenge the election result.
We are calling the people to defend their vote because they know what they voted and they have to protect what they vote for it. The election have to be cancelled. Can you tell me in which country where they can vote for 3 days in this whole 3 days voting? So we need these things to bring peace. We need to have the real election.
But in an interview with the BBC, the head of the Independent National Electoral Commission, Denis Kadima, rejected those allegations.
People always want democracy, but only when they win themselves. But the reality is everything that you see is the truly reflection of the will of the people. The voting took place in full view of observers, South Africa, Belgium, France, Canada and US. It was well conducted. It was democratic. There have not been any instance of manipulation of whatsoever.
The DRC is the second largest country in Africa with 44 million eligible voters. A reporter in the capital Kinshasa, Emery Makomeno, told us about the challenges of holding an election in the vast country.
The DRC is as big as four times the size of France, with very huge deficit of infrastructure. The 26 provinces can barely be connected by roads or any form of basic infrastructure. So for these elections here, the budget given by Mr. Katumbi there was over $1 billion. And this money was to be used to reach at least 75,000 polling stations in some remote areas where access is even impossible. You also have a plethora of candidates. More than 100,000 were registered as candidates to vote. So this is a lot of money and a big challenge when it comes to infrastructure.
Emery Makomeno. The authorities in Sri Lanka say criminal gangs are increasingly using the country as a hub for smuggling illegal drugs, notably heroin and cocaine. In a drive against drug trafficking, police have arrested thousands of people in the last week and seized hundreds of kilos of narcotics. Our South Asia correspondent Anbarasan Etherajan has been following the story.
It has been one of the biggest raids the country has carried out in recent years. It has been going on for the last 7 days. Hundreds of police officers, paramilitary commandos and even the military were involved in these operations going on across the country. And they were using sniffer dogs to search in different houses. And what the police are saying is that they have taken into custody nearly 14,000 people. Many of them were suspects, some of them were drug addicts. And they want to put an end, they want to control what they call as growing menace of narcotics issue. This is they have also seized hundreds of kilograms of various types of drugs, including heroin. Now, why this is happening in Sri Lanka now? Because the Sri Lanka is also a tourist nation. And now Sri Lanka's port, especially Colombo, works as a transshipment port for many countries like India. And many goods come from India. They get transshipped to Singapore and other places. The strategic location right at the southern tip of India, it gives for many people access to India. That was one of the reasons why Sri Lanka was being used as a transit hub. And it also leads to many gang wars in the capital, Colombo. In fact, there have been some shootouts. And even the Sri Lankan Navy was arresting a lot of people in the mid-seas.
But Anbarasan, there has been criticism of this huge operation, hasn't there?
There have been a number of human rights activists who say that the ongoing operation is, first of all, not legal because they did not have search warrants whenever they entered the house. So the human rights lawyers, they say that none of these warrants were shown, so they were illegal. The second aspect, if you look at what many people would say, is that most of these raids were being carried out in downtrodden areas and underprivileged communities. So you are targeting only a select group of people. and you are leaving out, you know, many of these drugs are available even in these high-end nightclubs and casinos in different places. So they are not being touched. You are only focusing only on the lower end of the society. And that is causing a lot of concern because these people do not have the ability to fight legal cases and they are being stigmatized.
And Barasan Etharajan, most of the 300 Indian nationals who've been held at a French airport are to be released on Monday. Their flight was on its way to Nicaragua, but was detained during a refueling stop. Here's Paul Moss.
It looks like they'll soon be on their way, but where to? More than 300 Indian nationals were on the chartered flight heading for Nicaragua, but then the French authorities received a tip-off they were being trafficked, with the United States as their final destination. The plane was held at an airport near Paris, and investigative judges have spent Sunday questioning the passengers. They've now said most can leave on Monday morning, but not whether the claims of trafficking were true or whether the plane can continue its journey to Central America.
Paul Moss. Our sense of smell is the one most closely linked to memory and can conjure up intense emotions. We asked colleagues here at the BBC to tell us about their favourite smells.
Early childhood in Wales. Coming home from school to find the kitchen full of steam and the smell of my mum's cowl or Welsh stew. Beef, carrot, onion, boiled potatoes. Perfect for a cold day.
My abiding memory of smell is the smell of books. The crisp, fresh smell of a new paperback, the yellowing pages of an old, hardbound classic, the musty odour of nostalgia. Books, though, are not for smelling, they're for reading. But whenever I open a book, I can't help noticing how it smells. And no matter how it reads, each book with its printed paper has a distinctive smell.
Now a project called Ode Europa is using artificial intelligence to develop new and unique ways of collecting information about smells to preserve for future generations. Will Tullett, Professor of History at York University here in the UK, researches sensory, embodied and environmental history. And Sean Lay, who was in the studio with other guests, asked him to explain more about his project.
Ode Europa is a project that really is interested in trying to find lots and lots of references to smell in the past and then kind of bring some of those smells back to the noses of people in the here and now. So what we were doing was we were taking vast amounts of kind of digitized historical texts from the 1600s through to the 1920s, looking for references to smells. Then we've built a kind of whole encyclopedia where people can begin to read about some of those and some of the stories about them. But we've also developed new kind of tools for them bringing smells back into museums. So we've devised a historical scent collection that's going to be deposited in the Osmotech, which is the world's kind of main, I guess, museum of perfumes in Versailles, and a kind of toolkit that will help museums to get smells back into their collections and to the noses of audiences.
Professor Tullett, I was just going to ask you to pick up on this idea that there's something different about the sense of smell. I heard somebody say in an interview yesterday on the BBC that actually the sense of smell goes somewhere different to where the other senses go in terms of how it is interpreted by the brain. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I should start by saying that we're kind of following the steps of Asia with this project because Japan was one of the first countries to make a list of 100 protected fragrant spaces that were voted for by the public. So Europe is kind of following on the heels of other countries. But yes, I mean, smell has a kind of direct connection to memory and emotion that many other senses don't possess. And it's for that reason that we often associate smell, particularly with many of our childhood memories, actually. One of the things that I was looking at was the smell of petrol. And for many people, they kind of admit that, okay, this may not be a particularly good smell for the environment, but it's a really nostalgic smell for them because it's connected to things like going on childhood holidays. So it does have this ability to conjure up our own past.
What about this idea you've got of reviving some smells? Tell us a bit about that.
So we've done that in various ways. One route we've taken with Dr. Cecilia Bembibre, who's at University College London, is to actually use the methods of analytical chemistry. So we will use various devices to capture the smells from objects or spaces. So we did a project at the British Motor Museum in Gaydon, where we captured the smell of one of the Queen's old Rover cars from the 1970s, analysed it in a lab, and then used the kind of chemical blueprint blueprint to recreate the scent. So we've now got this kind of blueprint and the recreation of the smell we can preserve. But some of them have been more sort of, should we say, interpretive and creative. So we did something with perfumers where we recreated the smell of hell based on, I mean, you could say we're living in it, but it was based on the smell of hell as described by early modern, so 16th, 17th century sermons, who described it as smelling like a million dead dogs, for example. And so he said to a perfumer, well, how do we create something that offensive?
Fascinating stuff from Will Tullett from York University here in England. And finally, a Christmas carol lost for nearly a century has been sung again by a full choir in a Yorkshire town in the north of England where it was originally written. The composition was recently rediscovered by museum archivists in Barnsley. Adam Gocher reports.
Written by a factory worker for the opening of Barnsley Town Hall in 1933, lyrics and sheet music for the song titled Christmas Eve were published in the local paper. Fast forward to this year and Arthur Godfrey's work was rediscovered in an old copy of the Barnsley Chronicle by staff at the town's museum, who decided to record a version of the song for their Christmas celebrations. Dr. Tegwyn Roberts was the voice behind the museum's recording.
For it to have gone viral and around the world is incredible. We've had community choirs that want to sing it. The Barnsley Music Hub have created a brass version for us. It's just overwhelming is probably the word.
According to the 1921 census, Arthur Godfrey was married with 7 children. The search is now on for any living descendants.
Adam Gocher reporting. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast on Tuesday. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Johnny Hall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor, as always, is Karen Martin. It's the 25th of December, and for those who celebrate, Merry Christmas from all of us, wherever you are in the world. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.